being was feared even more than Capricorn's men. He was known as the Shadow, and he appeared only when Capricorn called him. Sometimes he was red as fire, sometimes as grey as the ashes into which fire turns all that it devours. He leapt from the ground, like flame flickering up from wood. His touch, and even his breath, brought death. He rose up at his master's feet, soundless and faceless, scenting the air like a dog on the trail, waiting to be shown his victim. Fenolio swept a hand over his forehead and looked at the window. It was some time before he went on, as if he were recalling the words to mind from long ago. "They say," he continued at last, "that Capricorn had the shadow made from his victim's ashes by a troll or the dwarves who know all that fire and smoke can do. No one was certain, for it was said that Capricorn had those who had brought the shadow to life killed afterward. But everyone knew one thing. The shadow was immortal and invulnerable and as pitiless as his master." Fenolio fell silent, and Maggie, her heart beating fast, gazed out at the night. "Yes, Maggie," Fenolio said at last in a low voice. "I think Capricorn wants you to bring him the shadow. And God have mercy on us if you succeed. There are many monsters in this world, most of them human and all of them mortal. I wouldn't like to have an immortal monster on my conscience. A monster spreading fear and terror here for all time. Your father had an idea when he came to see me. I've already mentioned it to you, and it may be our only chance, but I just don't know how it will work yet. I must think hard. We don't have much time, and you ought to get some sleep now. When did you say this is to happen? The day after tomorrow?" Maggie nodded.
"As soon as dusk falls," she whispered.
Fenolio passed a weary hand over his face. "Don't worry about the woman," he said. "You may not want to hear this, but I don't think she can possibly be your mother, much as you may wish she were. How could she have come here?"
"It was Darius," Maggie buried her face in Moe's sweater, "the stupid man who can't read aloud well enough. Capricorn said so. He read her back out of Inkheart, and she lost her voice coming out of the book. She's back. I'm sure she is. And Mo doesn't know. He thinks she's still stuck in the story."
"Well, if you're right, then I wish she really were still there," muttered Fenolio, pulling the blanket up over her shoulders again with a sigh. "I still think you're wrong, but believe what you like. And now go to sleep." But of course Maggie couldn't sleep. She lay there with her face to the wall, listening to her own heart. Worry and joy mingled there, like two colours running into each other. Whenever she closed her eyes, she saw the nets and the two faces there among the cords, dust fingers, and the other face, blurred as an old photograph. Hard as she tried to see it more clearly, it always faded again. Dawn was breaking outside by the time she finally fell asleep, but the nightmares hadn't finished with her yet. They grew especially fast in the grey time between night and day, spinning an eternity out of seconds. One-eyed ogres and giant spiders stole into Maggie's sleep, hounds of hell, witches who ate children, all the bugbears she had ever met in stories. They crept out of the box that Mo had made her and jumped from the pages of her favourite books. Even the monsters came out of the picture books that Mo had given her before she knew the alphabet. They danced through Maggie's dream, brightly coloured and shaggy, their wide mouths smiling, baring their pointed little teeth. There was the Cheshire Cat she had always been so afraid of, and here came the wild things that Mo liked so much he had hung a picture of them in his workshop. How huge their teeth were! Dustfinger would be crunched between those fangs like a cracker. But just as one of them was stretching out his claws, the one with eyes as big as saucers, a new figure came out of the grey void, hissing like a flame, ashen grey and faceless, seized the wild thing, and tore it into scraps of paper. "Maggie!"
The monsters vanished, and the sun was shining on Maggie's face. Fenolia was standing beside her bed. "You were dreaming." Maggie sat up. The old man's face looked as if he hadn't closed his eyes all night, and he had several new wrinkles. "Where's my father, Fenolio?" she asked. "Oh, why doesn't he come?" Chapter 41. Farid. Farid stared at the dark until his eyes hurt, but Dustfinger did not return. Sometimes Farid thought he saw his scarred face among the low-growing branches. Sometimes he thought he heard his almost silent footsteps on the dead leaves. But he was always wrong. Farid was used to listening to the sounds of the night. He had spent endless hours doing so back in his other life, when the world around him was not green, but brown and yellow. His eyes had often let him down, but he had always been able to rely on his ears. All the same, Farid listened in vain that night, the longest night of his life. Dustfinger didn't come back. When day began to dawn above the hills, Farid went to the two captives, gave them water, a little of the dry bread they still had left, and a few olives. "Come on, Farid, untie us," said Silvertongue, as Farid put the bread in his mouth. "Dustfinger should have been back by now, you know he should have." Farid said nothing. He loved to hear Silvertongue's voice. It had lured him out of his old, wretched life, but it seemed that Dustfinger didn't like it any more. He didn't know why, and Dustfinger had told him to keep watch on the prisoners. He had said nothing about untying them. "Look, you're a clever lad," said the woman. "So use your head for a moment, will you? Are you going to sit here until Capricorn's men come and find us? What a sight we'll be! A boy watching two captives who can't lift a finger to help him. They'll fall over laughing." What was she called again? Ellie Noor? Farid had difficulty remembering the name. It was awkward as a pebble on his tongue, and sounded like the name of an enchantress from a far distant land. He thought her unnatural. She looked at him as a man might look, without timidity or fear, and her voice could be very loud and as angry as a lion's roar. "We have to get down to the village, Farid," said Silvertongue. "We must find out what's happened to Dustfinger and where my daughter is." Yes, the girl. The girl with the clear, bright eyes, little pieces of sky fallen to the earth and caught in her dark lashes. Farid poked the ground with a stick. An ant was carrying a breadcrumb bigger than itself past his toes. "Perhaps he doesn't understand what we're saying," said Eleanor. Farid raised his head and cast her a glance of annoyance. "Yes, I do. I understand everything." And so he had, from the first moment, as if he had never heard any other language. He remembered the Red Church. Dustfinger had explained that it was a church, although Farid had never seen such a building before. He also remembered the man with the knife. There had been a great many such men in his old life. They loved their knives and did terrible things with them. "You'll run off if I untie you?" Farid looked uncertainly at Silvertongue. "No, I won't. Do you think I'd leave my daughter down there with Basta and Capricorn?" Basta and Capricorn. Yes, those had been the names. The knife man and the man with the eyes as colourless as water. A robber, a murderer, Farid knew all about him. Dustfinger had told him a great deal as they sat together by the fire in the evening. They had exchanged sad stories, although both of them longed for one with a happy ending. Now this story was growing darker with each day that passed, too. "It'll be better if I go alone." Farid dug the stick so hard into the ground that it broke in his fingers. "I'm used to slinking into strange villages, strange palaces and houses. It was my job in the old days, if you know what I mean." Silvertongue nodded. "They always sent me," Farid went on. "Who'd be afraid of a thin young boy? I could sniff around everywhere without arousing suspicion. When did the guards change? Which was the best way of escape? Where did the richest man in the village live? If all went well, they gave me enough to eat. If it didn't, they beat me like a dog.
They?
Asked Eleanor.
The thieves, replied Farid.
The two adults fell silent, and Dustfinger still wasn't back. Farid looked toward the village and saw the first rays of the sun rising above its rooftops.
Very well, you may be right, said Silvertongue. You go down alone and find out what we need to know, but first untie us.
If you don't, we won't be able to help you if they do catch you. And I don't fancy sitting here tied up like this when the first snake wriggles past.
The woman looked as frightened as if she had already heard it rustling through the dead leaves. But Farid looked thoughtfully at Silvertongue's face, trying to decide whether his eyes could trust him as his ears already did. Finally, he stood up without a word, took the knife Dustfinger had given him from his belt, and cut them both free.
"My God, I'm never letting anyone tie me up like that again," said Eleanor, rubbing her arms and legs. "I feel as numb as a rag doll. How are you, Mortimer? Can you still feel your feet?"
Farid looked at her curiously.
"You don't look like his wife. Are you his mother?"
he asked, nodding in Silvertongue's direction.
Eleanor's face came out in more red blotches than a toadstool.
"Good Lord above, no! What makes you think that? Do I really look so old?"
Glancing down at herself, she sighed.
"Yes, I probably do. All the same, I'm not his mother. I'm not Meggie's mother either, in case that's your next question. My children were all made of paper and printer's ink. And that man," she said, pointing to the rooftops of Capricorn's village, shining through the trees, "that man down there destroyed a great many of them. Believe me, he'll regret it."
Farid looked at her doubtfully. He couldn't imagine Capricorn being afraid of a woman, certainly not one who got out of breath when she climbed a hill and was scared of snakes.
No, if the man with the pale eyes feared anything, it would be what most people feared. Death.
And Eleanor didn't look as if she knew much about killing, nor did Silvertongue.
"The girl," Farid hesitated before asking, "where is her mother?"
Silvertongue went over to the cold fireplace and took a piece of the bread lying among the soot-blackened stones.
"She went away long ago," he said. "Meggie was just 3. What about your own mother?"
Farid shrugged his shoulders and looked up at the sky. It was as blue as if the night had never been.
"I'd better go now," he said, putting his knife away and picking up Dustfinger's backpack.
Gwyn was sleeping close to it, curled up between the roots of a tree. Farid picked him up and put him in the pack. The marten sleepily protested, but Farid tickled his head and strapped up the pack.
"Why are you taking that marten?" asked Eleanor in surprise. "The smell of him could give you away."
"He may be useful," replied Farid, pushing the tip of Gwyn's bushy tail into the backpack too.
"He's clever. Cleverer than a dog or a camel, anyway. He understands what you say to him, and maybe he'll find Dustfinger."
"Farid," Silvertongue was searching his pockets and took out a piece of paper. "I don't know if you'll be able to find out where they're keeping Meggie prisoner," he said, hastily scribbling something with the stump of a pencil, "but if possible, can you try to see that she gets this note?"
Farid took the piece of paper and looked at it.
"What does it say?" he asked.
Eleanor took the note from his hand.
"Heavens above, Mortimer, what's this?" she asked.
Silvertongue smiled.
"Meggie and I have often sent secret messages in this writing. She's much better at it than I am. Don't you recognize it? It comes from a book. 'We're not far away,' it says. 'Don't worry. We'll soon get you out. Mo, Eleanor, and Farid.' Meggie will be able to read the message, but no one else will."
"Aha," murmured Eleanor, giving Farid the note back.
"Yes, if it falls into the wrong hands, it's better that way. After all, perhaps some of those fire raisers can read."
Farid folded the note until it was about the size of a coin, then put it in his pants pocket.
"I'll be back when the sun is above those hills at the latest," he said. "Or if I'm not?"
"If you're not,
I'll come and look for you. Silvertongue ended the sentence. And so will I, of course, added Eleanor, looking fierce. Farid did not think that was a good idea, but he didn't say so. He left, going the same way that Dustfinger had gone the night before, disappearing as if the ghosts who lurked in the darkness had eaten him alive. Chapter 42. A Furry Face on the Windowsill. Flatnose brought Maggie and Fenolio their breakfast, and this morning it was more than bread and a few olives. He put a basket of fruit on the table for them and a plate of small sweet cakes. But Maggie didn't at all like the smile he served up at the same time. All for you, princess, he grunted, pinching her cheek with his clumsy fingers. To strengthen your little voice. There's been a lot of excitement since Buster told us about the execution. Well, like I always said, there has to be more to life than hanging up a few dead roosters and shooting cats. Maggie exchanged a glance with Fenolio. The old man was staring at Flatnose with an expression of disgust that suggested he couldn't believe such a creature had slipped from his pen.
Yes, to be sure, it's been a terribly long time since we had a nice execution, continued Flatnose, on his way back to the door. It'd attract too much attention, they always said. And when someone really had to disappear, well, the word was to go carefully. Make it look like an accident. Is that any fun? You bet it isn't. Not like it used to be. A good execution with eating and drinking and dancing and music. That's the way to do it in style. And so we will this time, just like we did back in the good old days.
Fenolio took a sip of the black coffee that Flatnose had brought him and choked.
Don't you fancy that kind of thing, Grandpa?
Flatnose looked at him sneeringly.
Take my word for it. Capricorn's executions are something to remember. Who do you think you're telling? Muttered Fenolio unhappily.
At that moment someone knocked on the door. Flatnose had left it ajar, and Darius, the reader, put his head around it.
Sorry, he breathed, looking at Flatnose as anxiously as a bird obliged to get close to a hungry cat. I'm to get the girl to read something aloud. Capricorn's orders. Really? Well, let's just hope she reads something useful out of a book this time. Buster showed me the fairy. She doesn't even sprinkle any fairy dust, however hard you shake her.
Flatnose looked at Maggie with a mixture of dislike and respect. Perhaps he thought she was some kind of a witch.
Knock when you want to come out again, he grunted, pushing past Darius.
Darius nodded and stood there for a moment before sitting down at the table with Maggie and Fenolio, looking embarrassed. He stared greedily at the fruit until Fenolio pushed the basket over to him. Tentatively he took an apricot and put it into his mouth, as if he thought he would never in his life taste anything so delicious again.
Good heavens, it's only an apricot! Laughed Fenolio, not exactly a rare fruit in these latitudes.
Darius spat the apricot stone out into his hand, still looking awkward.
Whenever they shut me up in this room, he said timidly, they gave me nothing but dry bread. And they took my books away too, but I managed to hide some of them, and when the hunger got too bad, I looked at the pictures in them. The best was a picture of apricots. I sometimes sat for hours staring at the painted fruit with my mouth watering. Ever since then I just can't control myself when I see apricots.
Maggie took another apricot from the basket and put it into his hand.
Did they often shut you up? She asked.
The thin little man shrugged.
Yes, whenever I didn't read something out of a book properly, he replied evasively. Well, that meant all the time, really. Then they finally gave up because they realized that my reading didn't exactly improve when they frightened me. On the contrary. Take Flatnose, for instance.
He lowered his voice, casting a nervous glance at the door.
I read Flatnose out while Buster was standing beside me with his knife.
He raised his narrow shoulders regretfully. Maggie looked at him sympathetically. Then she asked hesitantly, "Did you ever read any women out of that story?" Fenolia looked at her uneasily.
"Certainly," Darius replied. "I read Mortala out of the book. She says I made her older and as rickety as a chair cobbled together badly, but I really don't think I got too much wrong with her. Luckily, Capricorn agreed."
"Any younger women?" Maggie was looking at neither Darius nor Fenolio.
"Oh, yes," Darius sighed. "On the same day as I read Mortala out. I remember it very well. Capricorn was living up in the north then, at a lonely, half-ruined farm in the mountains, and there weren't many local girls around. I myself was living not far away in my sister's house. I worked as a teacher, but in my free time I read aloud now and then in libraries and schools, or for children's parties, and sometimes on warm summer evenings I even read in a square or café. I loved reading aloud."
His gaze wandered to the window, as if he could catch a glimpse there of those long-forgotten, happier days.
"I think Basta noticed me when I was reading aloud at a party in the village, a passage from Dr. Doolittle. And all of a sudden, there was a bird flying around. I really didn't know I had the gift. Perhaps it was something to do with Basta being there. Anyway, when I went home, Basta caught me as if I were a stray dog and took me to Capricorn. First, he made me read gold out of books like your father did," he said, smiling sadly at Maggie. "But then I had to read Mortala out for him, and after that he told me to read his maidservants out, too. It was terrible." Darius pushed his glasses up on his nose with trembling fingers. "I was so scared. How can you read aloud well when you're terrified? He made me try 3 times. Oh, I felt so sorry for them. I don't want to talk about it."
He buried his face in his hands, which were as bony as an old man's. Maggie thought she heard him sob, and for a moment she hesitated to ask her next question, but then she did. "The maid they call Raisa," she said, her heart beating in her mouth. "Was she one of them?" Darius took his hands away from his face.
"Yes, she came out quite by chance," he said huskily. "Capricorn had really wanted another of them, but suddenly there was Raisa. And at first I thought I'd got it right for once. She looked so beautiful, almost improbably beautiful, with her golden hair and her sad eyes. But then we realized she couldn't speak. Well, that didn't bother Capricorn. In fact, I think he liked it."
He searched his pants pocket and brought out a crumpled handkerchief.
"I really could read better once," he said, sniffing. "But this constant fear. May I?"
With a sad smile, he took another apricot and bit into it. Then he wiped the juice from his mouth with his sleeve, cleared his throat, and gazed straight at Maggie. His eyes looked curiously large behind the thick lenses of his glasses.
"At the, festivities that Capricorn's planning," he said, lowering his gaze and running his finger awkwardly along the edge of the table, "the idea, as you probably know, is for you to read from Inkheart. The book's being kept in a secret place until that time comes. Only Capricorn knows where it is. So you won't see it before the, occasion, which means that we're to use another book for the latest test Capricorn wants of your talents. Luckily, there are a few other books in this village, not many, but anyway, I've been told to choose something suitable."
He raised his head again and gave a small, slight smile.
"Fortunately, I didn't have to look for gold and such treasures this time. All Capricorn wants is proof of your skill. And so," he said, pushing a small book over the table, "so I chose this one."
Maggie bent over the cover. "Collected Fairy Tales of Hans Christian Andersen," she read aloud. She looked at Darius. "They're beautiful stories."
"Yes," he breathed. "Sad, but very, very beautiful."
Reaching over the table, he opened the book for Maggie at a place that he had marked with a couple of long blades of grass slipped between the yellow pages. First, I thought of my favourite story, the one about the nightingale. Maybe you know it.
Meggy nodded.
But the fairy you read out of the book yesterday isn't happy in the jug where Basta has put her, Darius went on. So I thought it might be better if you tried the tin soldier.
The tin soldier. Meggy did not reply at once. The brave tin soldier in his little paper boat. She imagined him suddenly appearing beside the fruit basket.
No, she said. No, I've told Capricorn already. I won't read anything out of a book for him, not even as a test. Tell him I can't do it any more. Just tell him I tried and nothing came out of the story.
Darius gave her a sympathetic look.
Oh, I would, he said quietly. Really, I would. But it's the magpie,
he said quickly, putting his hand to his mouth as if he had said too much.
Sorry, I mean the housekeeper, of course, Signora Mortola. It's her you have to read aloud to. I've only chosen the story.
The magpie. An image of her flashed into Meggy's mind, watching her with her bird-like eyes. Suppose I bite my tongue, she thought, very hard. She had done that a few times by mistake, and once her tongue had swelled up so much she had to talk to Mo in sign language for 2 days. She looked at Fenolio for help.
Do it, he said to her surprise. Read aloud to the old woman, but make it a condition that you can keep the tin soldier. Tell her anything you like. Say you want to play with him because you're bored to death, and then ask for something else. Some sheets of paper and a pencil. Say you want to draw pictures, understand? And if she agrees, we'll take it from there.
Meggy didn't understand a word of this, but before she could ask Fenolia what he was planning, the door opened, and there was the magpie herself. Darius leapt to his feet so quickly at the sight of her that he pushed Meggy's plate off the table.
"Oh, I'm sorry, so sorry,"
he stammered, picking up the broken pieces in his bony fingers. He cut his thumb so deeply on the last piece that blood dripped to the wooden floorboards.
"Get up, you fool!" snapped Mortola. "Have you shown her where she's to read from?"
Darius nodded and looked unhappily at his bleeding thumb.
"Then get out! You can help the women in the kitchen. There are chickens to be plucked."
Darius made a face, looking disgusted. But he bowed and disappeared into the corridor, but not without casting Meggy a last sympathetic glance.
"Okay," said the magpie, waving to her impatiently. "Start reading, and put your mind to it."
Meggy read the tin soldier out of the story. It was as if he simply fell from the ceiling. He dropped down 3 stories to the street, and his bayonet stuck in the earth between 2 cobblestones. The magpie reached for him before Meggy could and stared at him as if he were just a painted toy, while he looked back at her with horror in his eyes. Then she put him in a pocket of her coarse-knit woolen jacket.
"Please, can I have him?"
stammered Meggy, just as the magpie reached the doorway. Fenolio placed himself behind her as if to cover her back, but the magpie just looked at Meggy with her sharp-nosed gaze.
I mean, there's nothing you'd want to do with him,"
Meggy went on uncertainly.
"And I'm so bored. Please?"
The magpie looked at her unmoved.
"You can have him back when Capricorn has seen him," she said, and then she was gone.
"The paper!" cried Fenolio. "You forgot to ask for paper and pencil!"
"I'm sorry," murmured Meggy. She hadn't forgotten, it was just that she didn't dare ask the magpie for anything else.
"Ah, well, I'll just have to get it by other means," said Fenolio. "The only question is, how?"
Meggy went over to the window, rested her forehead on the pane, and looked down at the garden, where a couple of Capricorn's maids were busy tying up tomato plants. "What would Mo say," she wondered, "if he knew I can do it too?"
"Who did you read out, Meggy? Poor Tinkerbell and the steadfast tin soldier?"
"Yes," murmured Meggy, tracing an invisible M on the pane with her finger. "Poor fairy, poor tin soldier, poor Dustfinger, and—" she thought again of the woman with the dark blonde hair.
"Teresa,"
she whispered.
"Teresa?"
Teresa was her mother's name.
She was about to turn away from the window when out of the corner of her eye she saw something appearing above the sill outside. A small, furry face. Maggie retreated in alarm. Do rats climb walls? Yes, but that wasn't a rat. The animal's muzzle wasn't pointed enough. She quickly ran back to the windowpane. Gwyn. The marten was sitting on the narrow sill, looking in at her with sleepy eyes.
"Buster," muttered Fenolio behind her. "Yes, Buster will get me the paper. That's a good idea."
Maggie opened the window very slowly, so that Gwyn wouldn't take fright and perhaps fall off the sill. Even a marten would break all his bones if he fell into the paved yard from this height. She put out her hand, still very slowly. Her fingers trembled as she stroked Gwyn's back. Then she grabbed him, before his little teeth could snap at her, and quickly lifted him into the room. She looked anxiously down, but none of the maids had noticed anything. They were all bending over the vegetable patch, their clothes drenched with perspiration from the heat of the sun burning down on their backs. There was a note under Gwyn's collar. It was dirty and had been folded very small and tied in place with a piece of tape.
"Why are you opening the window? The air outside is even hotter than in here. We—"
Fenolio broke off and stared in amazement at the animal in Maggie's arms. She quickly put a warning finger to her lips. Then, holding the struggling Gwyn tight, she removed the note from under his collar. The marten chattered crossly and snapped at her finger again. He didn't like being held too long, and would even bite Dustfinger if he tried it.
"What have you got there? A rat?" Fenolio came closer.
Maggie let go of the marten, and Gwyn immediately leapt back to the windowsill.
"A marten!" cried the astonished Fenolio. "Where did that come from?"
Maggie looked anxiously at the door, but obviously the guard outside had heard nothing. Fenolio pressed his hand to his mouth and looked again at Gwyn in such amazement that Maggie almost laughed.
"He's got horns," he whispered. "Of course, that's the way you wrote him," she whispered back.
Gwyn was still sitting on the windowsill, blinking uncomfortably at the sun. He didn't like bright light and preferred to sleep through the day. So how had he got here? Maggie put her head out of the window, but there were still only the maids down in the yard. Hastily she moved back into the room and unfolded the note.
"A message?" Fenolio leaned over her shoulder. "Is it from your father?"
Maggie nodded. She had recognized the writing at once, although it wasn't as steady as usual. Her heart began dancing inside her. She traced the letters with her eyes as longingly as if they were a path, with Mo waiting for her at the end of it.
"What on earth does it say? I can't make out a word of it," whispered Fenolio.
Maggie smiled.
"It's Elvish writing," she whispered. "Mo and I have been using it as our secret writing ever since I read The Lord of the Rings, but he's probably rather out of practice. He's made quite a lot of mistakes."
"Well, what does it say?"
Maggie read it to him.
"Farid, who's he?"
"A boy. Mo read him out of the Thousand and One Nights, but that's another story. You saw him. When Dustfinger ran away from you, Farid was with him."
Maggie folded the note up again and looked out of the window once more. One of the maids had straightened up. She was brushing the earth off her hands and looked up at the high wall as if she dreamed of flying away over it.
Who had brought Gwyn here?
Mo?
Or had the marten found his way by himself? That was most unlikely. He certainly wouldn't be wandering around in broad daylight unless someone else had a hand in it. Maggie hid the note in the sleeve of her dress. Gwyn was still sitting on the windowsill. Sleepily he stretched his neck and sniffed at the wall outside. Perhaps he could smell the pigeons who sometimes settled outside the window.
"Feed him some bread so he won't run away,"
Maggie whispered to Fenolio, and then went over to the bed and got down on her backpack.
Where was that pencil?
She was sure she had a pencil. Yes, there it was, although it was only a small stump.
Now what about paper?
She took one of Darius's books out from under the mattress and carefully tore out one of the end papers. She had never done such a thing before. Imagine tearing a page out of a book. but now she had to. Kneeling on the floor, she began to write in the same curly script that Mo had used for his message. She knew the letters by heart. "We're all right, and I can do it too, Mo. I read Tinkerbell out of her book, and when it gets dark tomorrow, Capricorn wants me to bring the shadow out of Inkheart to come and kill Dustfinger." She didn't mention Racer. Not a word to show that she thought she had seen her mother, and if Capricorn had his way, that she, too, had only 2 days to live. A message like that wouldn't fit on a piece of paper, no matter how large it was. Gwyn was greedily nibbling the bread Fenolio had given him. Maggie folded up the end paper and tied it to his collar.
"Take care,"
she whispered to Gwyn, and then threw the rest of the bread down into Capricorn's yard. The marten scurried down the wall of the house as if it were the easiest thing in the world. One of the maids screamed as he scampered between her legs and called out to the others. She was probably alarmed for Capricorn's chickens, but Gwyn had already disappeared over the wall.
"Good. Excellent. So your father's here," Fenolio whispered to Maggie, standing beside her by the open window. "Somewhere out there. Very good indeed. And you'll get the tin soldier back. Who was it who said that all's for the best in this best of all possible worlds?"
He rubbed the tip of his nose and blinked out at the dazzling sunlight.
"So the next thing to do," he murmured, "is to play on Bastard's superstitions. What a good thing I gave him that little weakness. It was a clever move."
Maggie had no idea what he was talking about, but that didn't matter to her. She had only one thought in her head. Mo was here. Chapter 43 A Dark Place. Dustfinger had expected Capricorn to leave him and Racer dangling in those dreadful nets until their execution, but they spent only a single, if very long, night there. In the morning, as soon as the sun cast its bright light on the red walls inside the church, Buster had brought them down. For a few horrible moments, Dustfinger thought Capricorn had decided instead to put an end to them in some quick and inconspicuous way, and when he felt solid ground under his feet again, he didn't know which made him weaker at the knees. That fear, or his night in the net. Whichever it was, he could hardly stand upright. Buster put his mind to rest for the time being, although that was certainly not his intention.
"Personally, I'd have liked to leave you dangling up there a while longer," he said as his men dragged Dustfinger out of the net. "But for some reason or other, Capricorn's decided to lock the two of you in the crypt for what's left of your miserable lives."
Dustfinger did his best to hide his relief, so death was still a little way off.
"I expect it bothers Capricorn to have an audience when he's discussing his filthy plans with the rest of you," he said. "Or perhaps he just wants us to be able to walk to our execution on our own two legs."
One more night in that net, and Dustfinger wouldn't even have known he still had legs. His bones ached so much after that first night that he was moving like an old man as Buster took him and Racer down to the crypt. Racer stumbled once or twice on the stairs and seemed to be feeling even worse than he was, but she made not a sound. And when Buster took her arm after she had slipped on one step, she shook herself free, giving him such an icy look that he let her go on by herself. The crypt below the church was a damp, cold place, even on days like this, when the sun was practically melting the tiles on the houses outside. It smelled of mould and mouse droppings, and other things Dustfinger didn't want to think about. Soon after arriving in the deserted village, Capricorn had had gratings fitted over the narrow niches where long-dead priests slept in their stone tombs.
"What could be more fitting than to make the condemned sleep on coffins?" he had said at the time with a laugh.
He had always had his own peculiar sense of humour. Impatiently, Buster pushed them down the last few steps. He was in a hurry to get back to the light of day, away from the dead and their ghosts. His hand shook as he hung his lantern on a hook and opened the grating over the first cell. There was no electric light down here, no heating either, or any other comforts. Only the quiet tombs, and the mice scurrying over the cracked flagstones of the floor.
"Oh, aren't you going to give us the pleasure of your company a little longer?"
asked Dustfinger, as Buster pushed them into the cell. They had to duck. They couldn't stand upright under the old vaults here.
"We could tell ghost stories. I know some nice new ones."
Buster growled like a dog.
"We won't be needing any coffin for you, dirty fingers," he said as he closed the grating again.
"No, indeed. An urn, perhaps. A jam jar. But no coffin."
Dustfinger took a step back from the bars so as to be out of reach of Buster's knife.
"I see you have a new amulet," he called.
Buster had almost reached the steps.
"Another rabbit's foot, is it? Didn't I tell you they attract white ladies? You could see the white ladies in our old world. You don't see them here, which isn't very practical. But of course they're still around, with their whispering and their icy fingers."
Buster was standing at the foot of the steps, with his fists clenched, his back still turned. Dustfinger was always surprised to find how easily you could scare the man with a few words.
"Remember how they come for their victims," he went on softly. "They whisper your name, Buster. And next thing you know, you're freezing cold, and then..."
"They'll soon be whispering your name, Dirty Fingers,"
Buster interrupted, his voice shaking.
"Yours, and yours alone."
And he hurried up the steps as if the ghosts of the white ladies were already after him. The sound of his footsteps died away, and Dustfinger was alone with the silence, with death, and with Rasa. They were obviously the only prisoners. Now and then Capricorn had some poor fellow locked in the crypt just to give him a good fright, but most of those who came here and wrote their names on the tombs disappeared some dark night and were never seen again. Their own departure from this world was going to be rather more spectacular. "My last performance, in a way," thought Dustfinger. "Perhaps it will turn out that all this was only a bad dream, and I just had to die to get home again." A nice idea, if only he could have believed in it. Rasa had seated herself on a sarcophagus. It was a plain stone coffin with a cracked lid, and the name that was once on it could no longer be deciphered. It didn't seem to frighten Rasa to be so near the dead. Dustfinger felt differently. He was not afraid of ghosts and white ladies like Buster. If a white lady had appeared, he would have passed the time of day with her. No, he was afraid of death. He thought he heard death itself breathing down here, breathing so deeply that no air was left for anyone else. His chest felt as if a huge and ugly animal were sitting on it. Perhaps it hadn't been so bad up there in the net, after all. At least they'd had air to breathe. He sensed Rasa watching him. She beckoned him over and patted the lid of the coffin. Hesitantly, he sat down beside her. She put her hand into the pocket of her dress, brought out a candle, and held it up to him with an inquiring look. Dustfinger had to smile. Yes, of course he had matches on him. It was child's play to conceal something as small as a few matches from Buster and the other idiots. Rasa fixed the flickering candle to the coffin with a little of its own wax. She loved candles, coloured candles and stones. She always had both in her pockets. But perhaps today she had lit the candle just for him, because she knew how he loved fire.
"I'm sorry. I should have looked for the book on my own," he said, passing a finger through the bright flame. "Forgive me."
She put her fingers on his mouth. Presumably she was saying there was nothing to forgive. What a sweet, silent lie. She took her hand away, and Dustfinger cleared his throat.
You didn't find it, did you?"
Not that it would make any difference now, but he had to know. Raisa shook her head and shrugged her shoulders regretfully. "That's what I thought," he sighed. The silence was terrible, worse than a thousand voices.
"Tell me a story, Raisa,"
he said quietly, moving closer to her.
"Please,"
he added in his thoughts.
"Chase my fears away. It's crushing my chest. Take us somewhere else. Somewhere better."
Raisa could do that. She knew endless numbers of stories. Just how she knew them, she had never told him, but of course he knew. He knew exactly who had once read her those stories, for he had recognized her face the instant he first saw her in Capricorn's house. After all, Silvertongue had shown him the photograph often enough. Raisa took a piece of paper out of her inexhaustible pockets. They contained more than just candles and stones. Just as Dustfinger always carried the means of lighting a fire, she always had a number of things with her. Candle stumps, a few pebbles, some paper, and a pencil. Her wooden tongue, she called it. Obviously none of these had seemed to Capricorn's men dangerous enough to be taken away from her. When Raisa told one of her stories, she sometimes wrote only half a sentence, and Dustfinger had to finish it. It went faster that way, and the story developed surprising twists and turns. But this time, it seemed she didn't want to tell him a story, although he had never needed one so badly. "Who is the girl?" wrote Raisa.
"Of course, Maggie."
Should he lie? Why not? But he didn't, although he didn't know why not.
"She's Silvertongue's daughter."
"How old?"
12, I think."
It was the right answer. He saw that in her eyes. They were Meggie's eyes, perhaps rather wearier.
"What does Silvertongue look like? I think you've asked me before." "Well, he isn't scarred like me."
He tried to smile, but Raisa remained grave. The candlelight flickered on her face.
"You know his face better than you know mine," thought Dustfinger, "but I'm not going to say so. He's taken a whole world from me. Why shouldn't I take his wife from him?"
Rising to her feet, she put a hand in the air above her head.
"Yes, he's tall. Taller than you, taller than me. Why didn't he lie to her?" "Yes, he has dark hair, but I don't want to talk about him now."
He heard the petulance in his own voice.
"Please."
Reaching for her hand, he drew her down beside him.
"Tell me a story. The candle will soon go out, and the light Bastard's left us is enough to see these wretched coffins, but not to read letters."
She looked at him thoughtfully, as if she were trying to guess at his thoughts and uncover the words he didn't say. But Dustfinger could guard his face better than Silvertongue, much better. He could make it impenetrable, a shield to keep his heart from prying eyes. What business was it of anyone else to know what was in his heart? Raisa bent over the paper again and began to write. "Hear and attend and listen. For this befell and behappened and became and was, O my best beloved, when the tame animals were wild," she wrote. Dustfinger smiled.
"The dog was wild," he whispered. "And the horse was wild, and the sheep was wild, and the pig was wild as wild could be. And they walked in the wet wild woods by their wild lones. But the wildest of all wild animals was the cat. He walked by himself, and all places were alike to him."
Raisa always knew what story he needed at any given moment. She was a stranger in this world, just like him. It couldn't be that she belonged to Silvertongue. Chapter 44. Farid's Report. When Farid came back, Silvertongue was waiting for him. Eleanor was asleep under the trees, her face flushed by the midday heat, but Silvertongue was still standing where Farid had left him. Relief spread over his face as he saw the boy coming up the hill.
"We heard shots," he called. "I thought we'd never see you again."
"They were shooting at cats," replied Farid, letting himself drop onto the grass. Silvertongue's concern made Farid feel awkward. He wasn't used to people being concerned for his safety. What kept you? Where have you been all this time? That was the kind of reception he was used to. Even Dustfinger's face had always been closed to him, as uncommunicative as a barred door. But with Silvertongue's face it was different. Anxiety, joy, anger, pain, love, it was all plain to see, written on his brow, even when he tried to hide it, just as he was now trying not to ask the question that must have been on the tip of his tongue ever since he saw Farid approaching. "Your daughter's all right," said Farid, "and she got your message, though she's shut up on the top floor of Capricorn's house. But Gwyn is a wonderful climber, even better than Dustfinger, and that's saying something." He heard Silvertongue breathe a sigh of relief, as if all the cares in the world had lifted from his shoulders. "I've even brought you an answer." Farid took Gwyn out of the backpack, held him firmly by the tail, and untied Meggy's note from his collar. Silvertongue unfolded the paper as carefully as if he feared his fingers might wipe away the words. "An end paper," he murmured. "She must have torn it out of a book."
"What does she say?"
"Have you tried to read it?" Farid shook his head and took a piece of bread out of his pants pocket. Gwyn had earned a reward. But the Martin had disappeared, probably to catch up on his long-overdue daytime sleep. "You can't read, is that it?"
"No."
"Well, not many people could read this anyway. It's the same secret writing that I used. As you saw, not even Eleanor can decipher it."
Silvertongue smoothed out the paper. It was a dull yellow, like desert sand. He read, and then suddenly raised his head.
"Good heavens," he murmured. "Imagine that."
"Imagine what?"
Farid bit into the bread he had been keeping for the Martin. It was stale. They'd have to steal some more soon.
"Meggy can do it too."
Silvertongue shook his head incredulously and stared at the note in his hand. Farid propped one elbow on the grass.
"I know. They're all talking about it. I heard them. They say she can work magic like you, and now Capricorn doesn't have to wait for you any more. He doesn't need you now."
Silvertongue looked at him as if this idea hadn't yet crossed his mind.
"True," he murmured. "Now they'll never let her go. Not of their own accord."
He stared at the words his daughter had written on the paper. To Farid, they looked like the tracks left by snakes slithering across the sand.
"What else does she say?"
"They've caught Dustfinger, and Meggy's to read someone out of the book to come and kill him. Tomorrow, when it gets dark."
He lowered the note and ran his hand through his hair.
"Yes, I heard about that too."
Farid pulled up a blade of grass and tore it into tiny pieces.
"It seems they've locked him in the crypt under the church. What else is in that note? Doesn't your daughter say who it is she's to bring out for Capricorn?"
Silvertongue shook his head, but Farid saw that he knew more about it than he was saying.
"Come on, you can tell me. Some kind of executioner, am I right? A man who knows all about cutting off heads."
Silvertongue acted as if he hadn't heard him.
"I saw something like that once," said Farid, "so it's all right for you to tell me about it. If the executioner is good with a sword, it's all over quite fast."
Silvertongue looked at him for a moment, astonished, and then shook his head.
"It's not an executioner," he said. "At least not a man with a sword. Not a man at all."
Farid turned pale. "Not a man?" Silvertongue shook his head. It was some time before he went on.
"They call him the Shadow," he said in an expressionless voice. "I don't remember the exact words describing him in the book. All I know is that I pictured him to myself as a figure made completely of burning ashes, red and grey, and without a face."
Farid stared at him. For a moment he wished he hadn't asked.
"They're all looking forward to this execution," he said in a faltering voice. "Those black jackets are in a really good mood. They're going to kill the woman Dustfinger was visiting as well, because she tried to find the book for him."
He burrowed his bare toes into the earth.
Dustfinger had tried to get him used to wearing shoes because of the snakes, but when you wore shoes, you felt as if someone was pinching your toes, so in the end he'd thrown them on the fire.
What woman? One of Capricorn's maids?
Silvertongue looked at him with a gleam in his eyes. Farid nodded. He rubbed his toes. They were covered with ant bites.
She can't talk. Dumb as a sandfly. Dustfinger has a photo of her in his backpack. She's probably helped him quite often, and I think he's in love with her.
It hadn't been difficult for Farid to explore the village. There were lots of boys there, no older than him. They washed the cars for the black jackets, cleaned their boots and their guns, delivered love letters. He'd delivered love letters himself in that other life. He hadn't had to clean boots, but weapons, yes, and he'd had to shovel camel dung. Polishing cars was much lighter work.
Silvertongue looked up at the sky. Tiny clouds were drifting by, pale as a heron's feathers, ruffled like acacia flowers.
Clouds often passed across the sky. Farid liked that. The desert sky he had known before was always empty.
Tomorrow, murmured Silvertongue, what am I to do? How am I going to get her out of Capricorn's house? Perhaps I can get in somehow by night. I'll need one of those black suits,
I've brought you one.
Farid took first the jacket, then the pants out of the backpack.
Stole them off a clothesline. And a dress for Eleanor.
Silvertongue looked at him with such obvious admiration that Farid blushed.
What an extraordinary fellow you are. Perhaps I should ask you how I'm going to get Meggy out of this village.
Farid smiled awkwardly and looked at his toes. Ask him. No one had ever asked him for his ideas before. He had always been the scout, the tracker dog. Others had made the plans for robberies, raids, revenge. You didn't ask the dog's opinion. You beat the dog if he didn't obey.
There are only two of us, and there are at least 20 of them down there, he said. It won't be easy.
Silvertongue looked over at their campsite and the woman asleep under the trees.
Aren't you counting Eleanor? You should. She's much fiercer than I am, and just at the moment she is very, very angry.
Farid had to smile.
All right, three, he said. 3 against 20.
Yes, I know, that doesn't sound good. Silvertongue stood up, sighing.
Come on, let's tell Eleanor what you found out, he said,
but Farid stayed where he was on the grass. He picked up one of the dry branches lying everywhere. First-class firewood. There was any amount of it here. In his old life, people would have gone a long, long way for wood like this. They'd have given good money for it.
Farid looked at the wood, rubbed his finger over the rough bark, and looked at Capricorn's village. We could get fire to help us, he said.
Silvertongue looked at him blankly. What do you mean?
Farid picked up another stick and another. He heaped them all up, all the dry twigs and branches.
Dustfinger showed me how to tame fire. It's like Gwyn. It bites if you don't know how to handle it, but if you treat it properly, it does as you want. That's what Dustfinger taught me. If we use it at the right time, in the right place.
Silvertongue bent down, picked up one of the branches, and weighed it in his hand.
And how are you going to control it once you've got a fire going? It hasn't rained for ages. The hills will be ablaze before you know it.
Farid shrugged. Only if the wind blows the wrong way.
But Silvertongue shook his head. No, he said firmly. I won't play with fire in these hills unless I can't think of anything else. Let's steal into the village tonight. Maybe we can get past the guards. Maybe they know each other so little they'll think I'm one of them. After all, we managed to slip through their fingers once, so maybe we can do it again.
That's a lot of maybes, said Farid.
I know, replied Silvertongue. I know.
Chapter 45 Telling Lies to Buster. It took Fenolio only a few words to persuade the guard outside the door that he had to speak to Buster at once. The old man was a gifted liar. He could spin stories out of thin air faster than a spider spins its web.
"What do you want, old man?
asked Buster when he was standing in the doorway. He had brought the tin soldier.
"Here, little witch,"
he said to Maggie, handing her the soldier.
"I'd have thrown it on the fire, but nobody here listens to me these days."
The tin soldier started at the word fire. His moustache bristled and his eyes looked so alarmed,